Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So here we are, and this for me is still very new territory. As most of you know, I've basically just arrived a few days ago from a very distant part of the world, from the old world as it's called, and so I'm still consider myself in the process of settling in. Maybe also today speaking to you, addressing you, helps me a little bit more to settle in, which also means, of course, to connect with people and to eventually then have the sense of, ah, yes, I've arrived, finally arrived, 100%, not just 80% or 90%. So when Ajahn Viradamo today approached me after lunch, he came over to my room and he actually said he wanted to invite me, and then he made a little pause. And for a moment I thought, oh, where are we going to go next, you know, after yesterday's outing? But then it dawned on me there was a certain tone in his voice which indicated a different kind of invitation. So the invitation then was, of course, if I would be willing to give a Dhamma talk. I hesitated for a moment or two because I didn't expect that. And then, of course, it was quite obvious, yes, of course I do, very happily, because I feel so welcomed here by the monastic community, but also by all of you who are very kind of, I hear, very staunch supporters. But one doesn't have to hear this, I can see it, I can feel it, that you're very much behind us. And it's a very good feeling to have in a place like this, in a monastery. And so, of course, then my next train of thoughts was going in the direction what to talk about, which is always a bit of a dicey issue, because there's so many topics one could pull out of the hat, so to speak. And I don't want to do that just by chance, to pull anything out of the hat. I don't have a hat, actually. So, so what would be, of course, the question then is, what would be helpful? What is suitable? What is appropriate? What resonates with you, the lay community, but also resonates with my fellow monk friends here. And so, as you probably also know, we have this, maybe we could call it a convention, where Dhamma talks usually are supposed not to be prepared in detail. I must say, actually, over the years, I've actually gone off that convention quite often, actually, and I've actually even sometimes had papers lying in front of me, and you know, picking out little Dhamma quotes or sort of texts and so forth, and really had a very detailed plan of what I'm going to talk about, especially when there's a retreat and you have a certain way you want to proceed with a certain theme on the retreat. But tonight there's only one thing which came to mind, which was the issue of conventions, as I'm talking about convention, the convention of giving Dhamma talks off the cuff, so to speak, which is a challenging thing for the best of monks, the best speakers even, for me in particular. So I try my best to, this is almost off the cuff, not quite, because I thought of talking about the significance of conventions in our particular setup, in our particular tradition. And this convention, Theravada Buddhism, then the sub-convention is the forest tradition, the sub-sub-convention is within the Lompo Cha tradition, as it's now called, or Sangha, the observances and practices which are maintained within the main monastery, Wat Nompapong, and also the branches in Thailand, and also, of course, the conventions followed overseas. And I've noticed that these conventions are not etched in stone, even though some people would like it to be like that. I've certainly noticed they're not etched in stone, they are actually changing. Not, of course, the basic structure and the fundamental structure, which of course is the rules and the discipline of our monastic code of conduct. It's kind of, I've actually seen them etched in stone in Burma. They have a whole huge yard with these, maybe Ajahn Vee has also visited when he was in Burma. It's in Upper Burma, where they actually have the whole Suttapitaka and Vinaya literally chiseled in stones, in white stone. Looks like big gravestones. And of course, this is I'm just imagining the task to do that, as what a kind of conviction and devotion has to be behind this, to do this. And of course, it's coming out of a spirit of veneration, of appreciation for this ancient tradition which we have inherited. But then, of course, another question is always, well, how do we take this convention into our life, in our daily life? How would you apply it? Is it really, even in our minds, etched in stone? Or is there some agility, some flexibility possible, how we use the conventions, even when it's coming to the observances of our monastic discipline? And I certainly, especially now, as I'm, as you've heard, I've put down my duties as the abbot and senior monk of a monastery, and I spent the first half year since leaving in an Italian monastery, which is, of course, belongs to the same family as the monastery I was living there for over 20 years. But I could even see then, going there, I could see slightly certain ways of doing things, certain rhythms and the routines and so forth. Those conventions are very flexible. And in a way, I really appreciate that each of our monasteries are in themselves quite autonomous. You know, we can decide. We don't have to always consult the Pope, the Buddhist Pope, or the cardinals. When we want to make little changes or in our routine and our observances, we can decide amongst ourselves. Of course, we always, in a community, we're encouraged to consult the others. Also, the abbot is not supposed to be, you know, mini pope in his own monastery and put the clamps down and says, "You follow me and shut up, be mindful." But we usually consult others. Well, how about if we do it like this? How about if you change the routine to actually also train all the members of the Sangha in developing that kind of agility of heart, of mind, which is not so dependent on conventions. In other words, we're not starting to cling to conventions. It shouldn't change, because if it does change, I start to feel very insecure and very afraid that I'm losing something very valuable. No, it's not, really doesn't have to be like that. Because it's all written out, the texts are there, the references are there. We can consult our elders and other monks when we want to have some unclarity in a certain area of the convention. And so, if we notice that if changes are applied in a monastery, in the routine or the way of doing things, and one reacts with a sense of fear and agitation, then rather than maybe blaming the senior monk or whoever is responsible for having done these changes, maybe we should look at ourselves. What is my attitude towards conventions, the conventional reality of things in a monastery? And so that would, I would suggest, be a wise approach rather than projecting it outward and saying, well, it shouldn't be this way. It should always be how I want it to be, or how it's always been, according to my perceptions, of course. What I'm used to, what I, how I expect the conventions to be and to stay forever and ever and ever. And so, of course, we are nowadays under a particular challenge as Buddhist traditions, not as our tradition, all traditions, are moving into the Western world. We've all heard these voices, these very extreme voices. One side of the voice is saying, well, throughout all this Asian stuff, it's just an extra burden. It really is in a way for the path of liberation. We have to find our own way, because we are a different culture, we are Western culture, we have particular backgrounds which are our cultural conditioning is different than the cultural conditioning of Asian people. And so some people take this very radical attitude and view, throw it out, it's just, blocking us on the way to liberation. And the other view I just kind of indicated already is to hold tightly on and let us not change anything. Let's maintain how it's always been, how we know it from, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 2,500 years ago, and the time of the Buddha. And so, of course, even with these extremes, when I speak like this, it sounds almost ridiculous, we could say, and a bit absurd. And of course, one exaggerates a little bit just to make a point that if we might just be leaning to one way or the other a little bit, but even then we have to investigate what is our attitude to the conventions we find ourselves in. How is it actually serving us? In other words, is it serving us on the way to liberation? Does it serve us to experience more and more a sense of freedom in the heart, a sense of ease, and a sense of relaxation in within ourselves and also with our in our relationships with the people we live with and the people we have to do in our daily life? And also this of course applies to lay life, where admittedly your involvements in the work sphere, in the family sphere and so forth, education and so forth, are much more complex than ours are. Ours have been streamlined. The Buddha streamlined the code of conduct and the lifestyle of the monks to those basics, which he thought would be helpful for us to move towards liberation. So the vinaya we have, the monastic rules, are supposed to be helpful tools. They're not supposed to be to gaggle us or tie us up into knots so that we don't dare to make a free movement. But they're supposed to encourage us, yes. If you look at them wisely and intelligently, you can see this is all there to help us to progress, to develop, and eventually, if things are going well, we will have maybe at least a glimpse of liberation in this life. And of course, we don't know how far within using the conventions we have this life is take us, if we have just a glimpse of liberation, if the result is one of the stages of liberation, the stream entry or one returner, non-return or arhant. But I would suggest not to worry too much about that. And I think we've heard from Lampo Someto in particular many times that he always encouraged us not to be anybody, not to be a stream enterer or Sotapanna, arhant or bodhisattva or whatever, but to attend to that what we can know, what we can realize in the immediacy of giving ourselves the adequate attention. And so then that takes us, of course, in the area of the practices, the methods, the teachings, where we're using the combination of the conventions, the vinaya convention, and the practices to work together, skillfully work together. So ethics in Buddhism, I certainly understand, and always to be in service of the liberation process, is never totally loose or removed from it. It's not, we're not observing ethics, 5 precepts or 8 precepts or 227 just to be good boys or good girls. We'll be using these as frames of reference for reflection so that then we can relax and we can use the practices to propel us onwards on the path. Admittedly, especially in monastic life, initially to take up all these observances seem awkward and for some people even impossible. Many people would never do it in the first place because they think it sounds impossible. And you probably heard the story of our teacher Ajahn Chah, that he at one point thought he was really very detailed in his study of the vinaya, and he thought, you can't do this. I mean, he was also, of course, studying the other rules outside of the Pratimokkha discipline, and you can't do this, all these observances, you go mad, just tossing this round in your head, thinking about all these rules. And then he had this very important encounter with this very well-known teacher and arahant in Thailand, Ajahn Mun, who was pointing him to the most important aspect. This is the gist of it. He was probably saying a little bit more, but he said, well, just don't forget, it's all about this. It's all about the heart, the development of the human heart. All these conventions, the regulations and rules and so forth are there so that we can develop. We can develop the heart. They're not there to tie us into knots and provide a constraint which make us unable to walk, to move, and to make the adequate steps that we at least in this life, if not reaching the goal completely, we're making a few very decisive and important steps towards it. And so then, of course, when we're speaking of steps towards liberation, we always ask ourselves, what is the relationship between conventional reality and ultimate reality or liberation? How do they relate to each other, these two aspects? Some people, rather than getting lost just in conventional reality and clinging and attaching to the convention, they attach maybe to the ultimate reality. They just say, oh, you don't need all this, just be mindful and aware and everything is fine, everything is perfect, you don't need to do much. This sounds very inviting, it sounds very wonderful, but of course we have to ask ourselves the question, can we do that? Is this real? Does this actually work? Because if we have a realistic, or most of us anyway, have a realistic view as our inner processes, the thoughts, the feelings, emotions and so forth, which we experience, then we say, well, yes, I can maybe make the determination from now on, I'll just be aware. But then, very quickly, it's still my reality, I admit, get taken over by train of thoughts, by commentaries and sub-commentaries, evaluations. I've learned a little bit in the area of judgments and inner critics and so forth, so that's improved quite a bit. But still, I can see that there are certain momentums in my mental, emotional experience which is almost going on automatic. And, this seems to be beyond my control. So if it's beyond my control, then what is the resume from that? What shall I do if I can't control it? Well, maybe I can investigate what gives me that sense that I can't control it, or even that I want to control it. Maybe it's not about control. Maybe it has nothing to do with control. Maybe it has to do with investigation, to investigate the mind state, the emotional state, which states lead to a sense of calm, which states lead to a sense of the heart getting a bit lighter and opener, gets a bit more benevolent, then we're coming into the area of putting wholesome, constructive impulses into the heart. We have the teachings on the Brahmaviharas, for example, which can nourish us in that way. And then we, of course, come to the teachings where the formal meditation teachings, where we're putting ourselves in the position of the observer. We witness the whole spiel of consciousness of the mind without interfering. And this is the training we have to do. Rather than coming from an idealistic standpoint and say, all I have to do is just be aware and everything's honky-dory. No. Say, well, what is going on? How can I be present for that which is happening in my mind? So I'm not controlling. How can I be present for a challenging emotion, for anger, for fear, for jealousy? For those kind of emotions which are not very flattering for our ego self. Is it possible? Can I do that? Or is it asking too much? Is this, again, overtaxing oneself and coming from an ideal standpoint? And so, of course, each and every one of us is invited, we could say, to this, to investigate for this for him or herself, we have to see not only what ability, but what tools we have available to be able to stay present, to just acknowledge and witness without going into resistance. And of course, the other way is without going into clinging. If something wonderful happens in our life, in our meditation, and then we tend to cling, we tend to hang on and want to make it last longer and endure, which also in a way is a resistance. It's resistance in two directions. So one is we want to annihilate and resist that which we don't like, we are afraid of, we feel challenged by, and the other is the resistance. We can't allow the change to proceed so that things can, as we all know, everything which arises passes away. But still, we know that all intellectually, don't we? And still we do it, huh? Mm-hmm. Everything arises and passes away. Still, no, stay here. I like you. I want you to stay longer. I want you to be here permanently in this blissful state, maybe, or this calm which comes over you in meditation. Well, this should not stay. I don't want to even open my eyes. But then your knees start to hurt, or your back. And you have to shift and move around. And then, of course, that kind of conditioned state, the state of calm or bliss and so forth, change and disperses. And we're back to square one. We're just back to our normal self. And that is not a catastrophe. This is just the way things are. And maybe we can then, rather than clinging to some wonderful state, we can just appreciate, yes, we have seen maybe another side of the mind, another side of the heart. We've experienced ourselves in a different way, maybe in a way we've never seen or experienced us before. And rather than saying, no, stay here, this is so wonderful, we can leave it as that and trust that everything we have seen or realized will inform our lives as such. Very often, actually, I've just actually on my way from Italian monastery where I spent the winter, I've been to various places giving 2-3 retreats, and the questions very often at the end of retreats which arises are what they can take with them going back to their normal life, to their the complexity of work and responsibilities and so forth. And especially, of course, very often you get this sense when people have had what they call a good retreat, which means in most people, I was really so calm, and I was, there was very little mental activity, and if it arose, I was immediately there for it and could let it go. My mind was really very in a very blissful state almost all of the time. And so then, of course, that can be very inviting to wanting to do transport that over into the other life. But there is no other life, actually. There's only one life. Even if you go on retreat, there's also life. There's life on retreat and there's life without retreat. And we suffer also in both areas. And so we can acknowledge as soon as we start to put conditions on state, on limited states, on conditioned states, then we will be in a conflict, and in a conflict, in resistance, and we experience the sting of suffering. It's quite natural that it happens like that. So then I always try to encourage people, don't take anything with you. Let things be as they were. It was what it was. The wonderful states were what they were. The not so wonderful were what they were. The terrible ones were what they were. And maybe actually you could call a good retreat the one which was really challenging, really difficult. You had a lot of maybe even physical pain. You had compulsive thoughts coming up, which you thought you had kind of resolved years ago. But this time you maybe peacefully coexisted with them. You didn't resist them. And still, maybe there was an underlying resistance which we're quite not aware that was happening. So the way we resist to the way things are have many, many strata, many layers. Some are very obvious and some are very subtle. So, say, in a retreat situation, when we give ourselves day in, day out for our full attention, we can also see the more subtle strata of our resisting strategies and holding on to things which we like and developing aversion, subtle forms of aversion towards the things we don't like. And so not to take anything with them, and sometimes people then get a bit, well, so I want to take something with them, but I want to also, I want to tell all my friends, you know, what it's like to have a good retreat, for example. But in that. Forget wanting to tell and impress all your friends with your wonderful meditation experiences. Well, what communicates best is just the way we are, or the way you are in that respect. That is the best communicator. The way we relate to people, the way we manifest in the different forms of empathic connection with people. Again, that's the kindness, the compassion, the appreciative joy, and the equanimity based on our wisdom faculty. If we attend and establish connections in that way with people without having an agenda, without becoming Buddhist preachers or think we have to kind of particularly exciting news to share, then people will be more open to appreciate that and accept it from us. A lot of the things which happens in human interaction actually happens non-verbal. You might have heard this. I think it has even been scientifically researched. Very little of the communication, effective communication, we share with each other happens on the merely on the verbal level. There's many other levels of communication where we exchange informations all the time. There's the voice, of course, the tone of voice, there's the body language, there's the gaze, the subtle way, the whole choreography, how we move through life, how we meet another person, how much space we give another person, how attentive we are to another person, how we respond, in all these things that is registered in our environment. And so that is always something really worthwhile to trust in. We don't have to have an agenda and think we need to, you know, convert everybody to Buddhism or to the Dharma. But we have to trust that what we have known, what we have realized, the Dharma. So in that respect, when I say the Dharma, I mean the truth about ourselves, in ourselves, that will communicate for itself. There's no need to take it into the ego domain, the domain of the ego, wanting to impress other people or wanting to appear special. But we're letting it very naturally come into human interaction. And then something good happens, something wonderful happens. We'll be surprised by the positive resonances we receive from other people. Maybe not from everybody, maybe somebody will challenge us, you know, question us, probe us, and so forth. And then, of course, then we can also prove, can we also stay present and in connection, have an empathetic connection with another person, even when we're challenged. And somebody says, I don't believe you. You're just making this up. But we know, huh? This is all, it's at the end of the day, this is all we have left. Only we know within ourselves what we have known, what we have realized, what we have truly seen for ourselves. Nobody can do this for us. Even the Buddha couldn't do this for his disciples. The Arahants couldn't do it. Our teachers, Lompo Cha, couldn't do it. Ajahn Sumedho couldn't do it. And all the other teachers couldn't do it for us. They could point the way, encourage us, be good examples maybe. But then the task is up to us, you know. How do I take all these pointers, all these recommendations, all these wonderful examples and integrate it into my personal life? So with that, I'd like to close tonight and hope that this will be of benefit to you.
So Handamayam Dhammakataya Sadhukarandadhamase
Sadhu.